Good morning, members and everyone. I'd like to call, excuse me, the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. So we are to order, Representative Clark Johnson. Excuse me. Representative Becker Finn, I saw your finger up. Was you just waving?
Yeah. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Beautiful week.
It is.
Mr. Chair, I just want to let folks know I am passing out an article here that ran in the Star Tribune late last week about chronic wasting disease, and just want to remind everyone that that's still a big issue we got to get taken care of. I'm wondering if we're going to have a hearing on that issue yet before deadline.
And I would also remind you that it's kind of customary to make sure that you run through the chair on stuff like that before.
I checked with staff.
All right. Very good. I was out in the hallway.
Yep. Nope. Sorry, Mr. Chair. I did check with your staff. Thank you.
So. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we were actually talking in the hallway.
We were.
During that. So
I was listening.
And we were discussing the policy bills for the agencies, and maybe if you just want to describe what we're doing there with the agency policy.
Sure. What we've done with the policy bills from the agency is we've kind of divided it into, three or four bills or whatever. We're going to move those two separately, get them on the general register. We did have a conversation, and I somewhat apologize. When the policy bill came to me, I was asked to sign on to it, so I did. And then upon further review, it would have been nice to maybe have engaged, say, Representative Uglem, who is leaving us, I guess, sadly. It would have been nice to maybe to have him or Representative Clark Johnson or somebody author those bills. So in light of that, I'm encouraging those folks to sign on to the bills, and maybe we can become engaged together on moving these things through the process. So, Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for acknowledging that. Actually, I am the author of the policy bill. I'd be more than glad to come with a comprehensive bill before this committee with the DNR at my side.
I'm sure you would. Thank you. Next, I'd like to move the minutes from March 8th. The minutes are before you. Any questions or comments on them or on the minutes? Representative Eklund, would you move the minutes for us, please?
I'd be happy to move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor of the minutes as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are approved. First up on our agenda today is House File 3577. So I will move House File 3577 to be re-referred to civil law. And we have some testifiers here. Chief author of the bill is Representative Anselmo. So with that, Representative Anselmo, we will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. The A1 is before you, members. Any discussion on the A1? All those in favor of the A1 as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the A1 is adopted. So we now have the bill, House File 3577, in the shape that the author would like. So Representative Anselmo, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and thank you for having me here. Your committee is my first committee meeting here, so we are passing around some, organic donuts from Edina. So it's not made, it's not fake news, so hopefully you enjoy those. There's actually some good salt on there. It's not road salt, so please enjoy. Well, thank you for hearing this bill. This bill has been a long time in the working, a number of years, a lot of people's efforts. I started on it this summer, and we're hoping to get this moved through today and move through civil law eventually. Bill number 3577. I've got a few testifiers here, and I'll let them explain the bill. I think we'll start out with maybe Larry Johnson and move down from there. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Johnson, would you identify yourself for the record and proceed?
My name is Larry Johnson.
Speaking of the microphone, please.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Larry Johnson. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association,
and I'm here representing our 41,600 members statewide, but specifically our 350-plus members who are employed in the winter months plowing and salting parking lots and sidewalks so we can be safe each time it snows. Along with the many members of our coalition, we are in support of House File 3577. There's a handout in your packet. I apologize. There is a handout in your packet listing the members of that coalition. We've tried to pull together a large group representing business interests, environmental interests, and others to show kind of the broad range of this bill. As Representative Anselmo mentioned, it's been introduced several times in the past, and we worked together to try to come up with some language that would address several different concerns that have been raised across the board from the environmental interests, from business members, and from others. Basically, the reason for the bill, our members, the snowplowers and salters, will come to a parking lot and salt in accordance with best practices that they've learned. And in many cases, to address the concern about a potential slip and fall lawsuit, they will come back and salt sometimes twice as much and more than is necessary just to keep that client protected and keep themselves protected from any potential litigation. The legislation gives our members and anyone else really the opportunity to take a smart salting class and get certified as a water-friendly maintenance provider. And then if they've gone through that coursework through the PCA, they would then be granted a limited liability from potential slip and fall accidents that would result from a slip on a sidewalk that had been salted. I want to recognize our member Tim Maluli with Water in Motion, Irrigation by Design, and Dulcet Fountains. He's actually, he hires the salters and the snowplowers in the winter, and I wanted him to speak from a business perspective on what he's experienced. I know a lot of you saw a recent article or a recent story from the Minnesota Public Radio. Mr. Maluli was featured prominently in that story, so if you saw that, this is Mr. Maluli in the flesh. So at this point, I will hand off and let him speak.
Mr. Maluli, let the flesh speak.
In the flesh. Good morning, Chair Fabian and committee members. My name is Tim Maluli. No autographs, please. I'm here this morning to speak in favor of House File 3577. I am a member of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. As Larry Johnson indicated, I'm the founder of three small businesses, each of which concentrates on outdoor water use and reuse. For a brief summary, one company, Dulcet Fountains and Aeration, helps clients manage aquatic environments, including ponds and small lakes. Dulcet Fountains staff sees firsthand the damage that can be done from winter chloride application to water bodies and to the nearby vegetation. A second company, Water in Motion, is an outdoor water use and reuse design and consulting firm working throughout North America. We design conventional landscape irrigation systems and rainwater and stormwater management systems, and we monitor and report on stormwater best practice or BMP performances. Salinity of water is a common measurement point when evaluating for reuse of stormwater and, of course, when measuring BMP performance over time. The third and oldest company is called Irrigation by Design. IBD is a residential and commercial landscape irrigation construction and service company based in Minneapolis, serving primarily the metro area with projects in greater Minnesota as well. IBD performs snow and ice activities in the winter months, including truck and machine plowing, shoveling, and anti-slip services, including the application of fluoride. Aside from the customary actions of clean and treat, There's a trend we've noted the past 4 or 5 years whereby clients, most notably homeowner association-based accounts, request levels of de-ice activity often reserved for hospitals or the hospitality industry. That is a preemptive activity with the hope of minimizing slip and fall events. Most of this trend is at HOAs where there are higher concentrations of senior citizens. The desire on the part of the client is notable, first, to furnish a safe outdoor environment to residents and guests, and second, to avoid legal action against the association should a person be injured from a fall involving snow and ice. One problem is that the client does not understand the proper application of products, most notably salt. Since the salt is less expensive than other methods of anti-slip, an unknowing client simply believes that if some is good, then more must be better. One result of this trend, in addition to the usual pressures on the snow and ice professional, is over-application of salt, in which, in many cases, is ineffective, and in some cases can actually result in increased ice. Some applicators who may not know better simply shrug their shoulders in the face of the request for more salt and apply, and, of course, charge their clients by the pound or by the bag for their service. If snow and ice professionals obtain best practice-based accreditation, they will undoubtedly have more choice in when, where, and how to apply de-ice materials for maximum effectiveness and minimum impact on the environment. Informed persons will also have the ability to educate their clients and help condition client expectations in regard to the realities of managing the outcomes of Mother Nature's storms. The limitation of liability component of this legislation furnishes incentive for a business owner to train and to invest in his or her employees, and if proper records are kept, limit the business should an incident result in a suit. I'm hopeful that the approach intended by House File 3577 will result in greater appreciation for accredited professionals and will have the effect of improving snow and ice management outcomes for both our citizens and the environment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm impressed by the broad coalition. I'm just wondering if any time during the broad coalition's meeting, anybody said, hey, maybe we should actually talk to the minority and see if we could have one Democrat, maybe just one, co-author the bill.
The justifiers.
That's a good question. I think everyone knows here I love Democrats, so I would have loved to find one, but we weren't successful. We'd probably have some time to add them on, and would be happy to do so. Sure.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, you're not successful when you don't ask.
Representative Anselmo.
I just have to ask a little louder next time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The bill's been around for quite some time. And go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
I would like to add the Senate file 3199, and we did have several Democrats who were interested in signing on. The one who did sign on was Senator Tom Sumney. We had also talked to Senator Eaton and Senator.
Speak into the microphone, please.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Is that better?
Yep.
Okay. I apologize. Mr. Chair, Senate File 3199 is the companion of this bill. Senator David Tomassoni is a co-author of that bill, and as you know, with only five slots, we were limited in the number, but we did also speak with Senator Eaton and Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
There's 35 slots in a House.
Is it by default?
Nope. But
okay, hold on here. Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you finished presenting the bill?
Can you speak into the microphone, please?
Is there something else you're going to say about the bill? Because I have some questions specifically about the language.
Representative Anselmo.
Mr. Chair and Rep. Wagenius, we have three more presenters to go through here, so there's more to be said.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Well, are they going to be talking about the language of the bill?
Representative Anselmo, I would guess that MPCA will be talking about the language in the bill, but I don't know that for sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, let me just then ask this question so maybe the presenters can address it.
And into the microphone, please.
So I am not understanding from the testimony so far how much of the salt problem that this will solve? Do you have an estimate of how much of the problem is solved?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I do not have estimates on what, how much of this oversalting problem this will solve. This is simply a first step, and we can move from here. I don't know if the PCA will include that in their testimony. They may have better information than I do.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. That brings up the question, and you can't manage what you don't measure. And there's no measurement provision in here. Are you thinking about putting in a measurement of does this work? I mean, since it's voluntary, maybe three people sign up instead of... So how are we going to know if this is helping or not? And to what extent, and are we solving the problem, or are we just, it does feel to me like we need a way to measure the result, not how many people sign up, but actually in the water.
Representative Wagenius, if I could interject here, I think that's a good question for PCA, if I may, but,
that's
okay.
Fine. If somebody would answer it, that would be helpful.
We'll get to that. So, PCA, we've got Shannon Lothammer is here. Would you come down, please? Identify yourself for the record, please, and then we'll go back to Representative Wagenius for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Did you hear the question?
Very good.
I did, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius. So overall, when we look at the issue of chloride building up in our waters, statewide, it's roughly about 50% is from de-icing chemicals and about 50% is from home water softener use. And that gets passed through the wastewater treatment facilities. But when you look in the metro area, it's about two-thirds to one-third. So about two-thirds is from de-icing chemicals, and about one-third is from home water softener use. So there's a big potential for improvements by reducing the amount of salt that's used for de-icing.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, the question is, does this bill, how far is it going to take them? Are we going to get a 1% reduction, 10% reduction? What's our baseline measure, and how are we going to measure going forward whether we need to do this or something else?
Commissioner Lothammer.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we do have baseline information from the statewide total maximum daily load study that was done in the metropolitan area on chloride in our waters. So that provides baseline for us to measure again or measure from. And when it comes to the specific practices, I know from speaking with Connie 14, who does the training, and she's also will be one of the testifiers, that she's seen as much as a 50% reduction in salt use from users that before they take the training and then after they take the training. And there's estimating tools and record-keeping tools that is a part of that training that can help those that take the training to really quantify the reduction that they're seeing. So all of that information will help us evaluate then over time the effectiveness of this effort compared to the needs that are shown that show up in the TMDL.
Representative Wagenius.
But this is a voluntary effort. We don't know. I mean, how long are you going to let it go on before you say, wait, this doesn't work, or it doesn't, maybe it's working for a few people, but it doesn't work in the big picture?
Commissioner Lothammer.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I think the voluntary training that we have had some grant funding to do has been very effective. I think by adding the liability protection, that will incentivize more participants. So we really have seen a lot of demand and a lot of interest, and we believe and we're supportive of the the liability protection to really increase that demand. If we got to the point where we weren't seeing interest or we weren't seeing benefits, then we would need to look at what might be some other steps that could be taken and come back to the legislature with additional ideas.
Representative Wagin, yes.
Well, the final question. So your measurement seems to be not what's happening to the water, but how many people are participating in this program. So then the question becomes, how many people are commercial applicators of salt?
Commissioner Lauthammer, thank you.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, first, we are measuring in the waters as well. So that is part of the work that the Pollution Control Agency does, both looking at groundwater and surface waters. We have a lot of partners in the metropolitan areas that do that surface water sampling. So it's not just looking at the numbers that are participating in this effort, but also what are the trends in the water resources. As far as the number of commercial applicators, I don't have that information. I'm not sure if another testifier does. Otherwise, we could certainly get back to you with that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions are on line 1.15 on the training program. Ms. Lauthammer, so it says, you mentioned grants, but it says the Commissioner of Pollution Control Agency must support a training program. So does that mean financially? Does it mean with staff? The training programs that exist for other commercial applicators have a state lead agency that certifies but doesn't do the training, that the training is usually done by the University of Minnesota, and that there's a differentiation between training, education, and licensing or certification. So could you delineate what your role would be and what that cost would be, even if it's a grant, because you have to have a fiscal cost for administering the grant?
And before I answer that, I will say that there's a fiscal note that has been requested on the bill, and if need be, we can bring it back to this committee. Commissioner Lauthammer.
So, Mr. Chair, so maybe just if you would indulge me, I'll just talk a little bit more generally about the bill since this is getting at some of what I was planning on testifying. Is that okay?
You're on the way.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So first of all, I want to thank Representative Anselmo for the A1 amendment to broaden the language of the applicability from salt to de-icing chemicals, because that does bring in some additional best management practices that can help move away from the use of de-icing chemicals that have chloride in them. So just want to make that point. And so the agency is definitely very supportive of efforts to promote best management practices for de-icing chemicals. But we do have two concerns with the bill that we've discussed with the author and that the author is aware of. And first gets to your question, Representative Hansen, and that's the funding. So the bill currently lacks a mechanism for funding the certification program that's called for in Subdivision 2, which thereby creates an unfunded mandate. The way that the volunteer program works right now is the agency has a grant from the Environmental Protection Agency that will provide training through about June of 2019. But that grant is really focused on the voluntary program, not a certification program for the liability protection. So in order to provide that certification program, the agency would need to be able to charge a fee or have some other kind of funding source. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the resources to offer the training that would involve the liability protection and the certification. The way that the program works right now is that the agency actually contracts with an independent contractor. That contractor is Connie Fortin from Fortin Consulting, and it's Ms. Fortin that provides that training then. And all of the funding that the agency currently has with the grant from the EPA has already been obligated through that contractual arrangement. The EPA funding also requires a 50% match from local communities, so it's just set up a little differently than a certification program would be. So we do have that concern about the funding, But and part of that concern is that we wouldn't have the resources to track the certifications, so track the training and the testing and the record keeping for the purposes of the liability protection. But as Chair Fabian noted, a fiscal note has been requested, and that information is forthcoming. That fiscal note is due March 20th. And we certainly want to work with the author and work with the members to find a sustainable approach to keeping this program moving forward and funding this training. Then we just have a smaller concern. I mentioned that we had two concerns. And that smaller concern is just that introduced, the bill has the potential to create some confusion amongst the certified applicators, given that the statute of limitations being protected from liability under Subdivision 3A is 6 years, but the record keeping is 2 years. But again, that's something that we'd be happy to work with or contribute to that discussion, however, would be useful to the legislature. But again, we're very supportive of efforts to reduce chloride through training and certification. We very much appreciate the dialogue happening around this bill, and we certainly want to work with the legislature on this effort however we can. Because chloride, of course, is a problem. It builds up in our environment, and it doesn't go away. It doesn't break down like some of the other contaminants that we see. And so it's continuing to build up in our lakes, in some of our lakes and streams and groundwater. And the solution is really prevention, keeping that chloride out of the water in the first place.
And members, to the point of the Subdivision 3 with regards to the liability, I think that that's an issue that will be vetted fairly significantly in the Civil Law Committee. So maybe avoid some of that here today. But Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lothammer, you discussed, you used some terms interchangeably, certification, training, and you did mention testing. So do you, or maybe this is to the author of the bill, do you envision an initial test to determine minimum competency, or is attending a class the minimum competency measurement?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I believe, and I'd maybe defer to Connie Fortin, who does the training specifically, but the real kind of information is imparted by attending the class and working through scenarios about different storm events and what are best management practices for both addressing the public safety needs associated with those ice and snow events, but then also how to do that in a way that reduces the salt application. So the important piece is really going through that problem solving and that decision making and helping the applicators kind of think through scenarios about what might be options for still, again, meeting that public safety need, but in a way that is going to be more protective of our water resources by using less salt.
And to that point, President Hansen, we have Ms. Fortin is on our testifier list. If you want, I'll call her down. And then, why don't you come down, please?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a key point because it ties back into the liability. If you're going to use the training as a minimum competency, so doing training is one thing if you're doing continuing education or awareness or... but when you tie the regulatory hook into it and provide the liability waiver, there has to be a measurement, some type of measurement or some verification that will stand up that you're measuring or you've provided minimum competency. So the liability, it ties back to the liability that if you're providing the waiver on liability, there must be some assurance to the public that the people who have gone through the training have a... have met a minimum standard, and then you have continuing education to continually update that standard so that they continue to demonstrate that they're knowledgeable in order to achieve that regulatory benefit. And it seems kind of thin here in terms of the bill on laying that out.
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, if I could direct you to line 2.19 of the bill, it does note that, and it starts on line 2.17, that to receive the liability protection that's provided, the applicator must pass an exam, have a current certification, and complete the assessment tool requirements that the agency would develop, which looks at the kind of the pre and post and the use of the best management practices to reduce the salt use. So there are some of the provisions that you're concerned about to make sure that it's not just a one-time thing and there's not sort of ongoing assurance that those practices are being followed.
Representative Hansen.
And, Mr. Chair, that gets to the cost. So if, and Mr. Malooly knows this because I've done the commercial applicator program for years before I came here. In the early 2000s, when we established the commercial manure applicator program, there had to be an appropriation in early 2000 dollars of about $100,000 in order to do the manual. And the manual had to be written for content that the test could be written to. We actually had, so we spent about $100,000 at that time to have a defensible test for certification. Now that's going on 15, 16, 17 years ago, and it had to be run through the University of Minnesota so you'd have the independent knowledge, not commercial knowledge, but the independent certification test to come back. So I think there are a number of questions here in terms of cost that are embedded into this bill that could have been raised earlier.
Just, Ms. Fortin, okay? If you have a comment on the last comment.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Connie Fortin. I own Fortin Consulting, a small environmental consulting firm of four people based in Hamel, Minnesota. And back over 10 years ago, I saw the over-application of salt across the landscape. I thought we needed a training program in this state, and I applied for funds through the Pollution Control Agency to develop this program and to teach the program. And about 10 years later, we've had over 10,000 people across the Midwest go through this training program. It is the best in the nation. Right now, we have a parking lot and sidewalk winter maintenance manual that's current, has progressive practices in it. We have a half-day curriculum. We have class exercises, and we have a test. In addition to that, we have supporting material, which is an online assessment tool where you can go in and you can look at your past practices, your current practices, and you can predict your future practices. You can even do a salt savings calculation. As you change a practice or you predict a practice to change, you can see how much less salt you'll use in the future should you have the same winter.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to read something here from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and it says, excess chloride levels in lakes and rivers are increasing and cause for concern in Minnesota. High levels of chloride are harmful to aquatic plants and animals and may also impact groundwater used for drinking. Unlike nutrients such as phosphorus or nitrogen, chloride permanently pollutes water because there is no cost-effective, and I want to highlight cost-effective, easy method to remove it. Commissioner, could you tell me what methods would be able to remove this?
Commissioner Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, so if you're talking about a method in the water, well, so really the only method that's currently available to address salts, which chloride is a form of salt, is reverse osmosis. So membrane technology that forces water through a membrane keeps the salt on one side and the pure water on the other side. So that's just not practical to do in the water itself once the chloride gets into the water. And there is treatment technology for like wastewater treatment, but it's very expensive because of both the cost of the membranes, the cost of the energy that it takes, and then also you still end up with a waste stream that's more concentrated salts that you have to dispose of in some way.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you were at a meeting in my district in regard to the sulfate standard, and I just wanted to remind you, you said the fish don't care about cost.
Commissioner Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, I believe that that was in the context of setting a water quality standard, which the question that, or the concern that folks had was the cost of a particular, achieving a particular water quality standard in a water body. And that really got to the fact that under the Federal Clean Water Act, cost is not a determinative factor in establishing what a standard needs to be, because the standard is based on what is the environmental conditions that are needed to protect a particular beneficial use. So my example was the fish don't care if it's expensive to remove oxygen or to add oxygen, or it's cheap to add oxygen. They just need the oxygen. But, of course, humans care about the costs, and when it comes to implementing and achieving water quality standards, those costs really come into effect, thinking about how quickly can we achieve that, you know, what are the tools that we use, because, of course, you know, there are times when treatment is just prohibitively expensive. So the standard doesn't change based on the cost, but how we get there or how quickly we get there certainly may.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think this is a good bill and a good start, and we know issues like this will lead to cleaner water, and especially with preventative measures on the front side. So I applaud you all for working on this. But I think we've got to be realistic about what we're focusing our energies on. I know, for example, if we have high salination levels in our water up north, we'd have a lot less growing. Fortunately, we don't have the density down here that the metro does in salted roadways, parking lots, storm sewers, but it is something I think we should be cognizant of moving forward. I'll continue to follow the issue.
All the more reason why people should live in rural Minnesota. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the, either the author or our representative from the MPCA, I was wondering when we're talking about the certification program, I'm used to seeing in the state when they do certification programs, there's usually a fee. Are you folks envisioning that there's going to be a fee already, or is that something that needs to be built in statute to make sure that is possible?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is, so how to pay for that certification is a question that we have raised as well, and that certainly there's been a fiscal note that's been requested, and so the cost will be a part of that. But, you know, we leave it to the legislature to determine how that funding should be provided, whether it's a fee or an appropriation. We're just expressing the concern about the need for funding.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I like the bill where it's going right now. I think one of the things we need to do is take a look at the fee. And the reason I bring it up is the Department of Health does a lot of certifications. And one of the things they do is in their certifications, there is always a fee when you make applications for the certification, and that is called out. So I would recommend that gets included as part of the process. And that's just kind of an example of what we've done in other areas of government when we're having these kind of certifications that are put out there. And then finally, one thing as I was doing, just quick notes here, is I know that this will make a nice reduction. You know, if everybody adopted this, we could get a 25 to maybe 33% reduction in salt use. It would be good to have ideas of what are other things that we might be looking at or things that we might need to address the other parts of the problem that are out there. And that might be a bigger discussion going forward, but I think that still leaves a lot on the table that we need to address.
Very good. I'm sure that next time we're on the House floor, you can get Representative Anselmo to sign one of those little green slips and you can become a co-author. Representative Anselmo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we want to hear any more testifiers? Are we ready to?
We got four questions here. Representative okay. Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious about de-icing materials. This relates to the amendment. Do all de-icing materials currently used in Minnesota have salt? Or chloride, rather?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the most common de-icers used in Minnesota today are, the most common is sodium chloride, which is a salt. Second would be either magnesium or calcium chloride, which are also all salts and chloride containing. However, we do use in smaller quantities urea or acetates, usually where there's really expensive infrastructure like a bridge or airport.
Representative Johnson, follow-up?
Thank you. Yeah, and that relates to considering that those, my next question then, with the amendment, those would be included with this, even though there is no salt included. I also is, and a corollary question, is sand considered a de-icing material?
Ms. Fortin.
Mr. Chair and committee members, sand would not be considered a de-icer or be considered an abrasive. I forgot what your first part of your question was.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, my apologies. That was not fair to you. But so why would – why? My question is why include those de-icing materials that don't include salt? It would seem to me we'd want to be encouraging those materials. Granted, they're expensive, but if so's the problem.
Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, members of the committee, so the reason why the agency was definitely supportive of the A1 amendment is that then by including those other de-icing chemicals, if an applicator switches from a chloride-based de-icing chemical to one of these other chemicals that are developed, that would still be considered and part of the liability waiver or the liability protection. Our concern was that if the definition was specific to salt and best management practices could only consider salt, so calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, those chloride-based, then that might provide a disincentive for actually moving towards some of these non-chloride-based de-icers. And there is research being done even by Minnesota companies to look at alternatives to using chloride-based de-icers. So we just wanted to make sure that the broad range of tools and options were considered and part of the training and the best management practices that were available to commercial applicators.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Chair. Ms. Fortin, do you have an estimate of how many commercial applicators there are in Minnesota?
Ms. Fortin.
A rough estimate even?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't have an estimate. But I do have an answer to one of your previous questions.
Okay.
So if we look at the people doing winter maintenance, our city, county, and state winter maintenance crews are more highly educated than our private sector. And when we have three barriers with the private sector to get them to use a reasonable amount of salt. One is to get them educated so they understand the options, which this legislation would help with. The second is many companies bill their salt as a profit center. Okay, that is not going to help with this legislation. That may be something in the future to consider. The third is the liability, because when they do the winter maintenance for a Target or a Home Depot or an organization, they have to sign the contract that says they are going to be liable for a slip and fall. They put the salt on thick because they think that's how they're going to be protected. So I think this legislation will take care of two-thirds of the problem with that sector.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, you're telling us about salt being a profit center. That's scary.
Yeah.
So thanks for sharing that. I mean, I think it's important that we know that that's how this industry is structured. The other question I had was Scandinavian countries have the same kinds of problems we have but seem to approach it differently. Are you aware of what they do differently that might be helpful for us?
Ms. Wharton.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm not familiar with their practices.
Yes. Is PCA familiar with their practices?
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not.
It does seem that we could learn from them instead of maybe having the university create things all by, start from scratch. That's troubling. Let's borrow from people who are already have done some more problem solving than we have.
Thank you. Next, Sue Nissen and Steve Wood. Good morning. Would you identify yourselves for the record and proceed?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to thank Representative Onsamo for introducing this important legislation. My name is Sue Nissen. I am with Stop Over Salting. We are a group of citizens advocating for the reduction in use of de-icers. I'm a master water steward, a community volunteer, trained in watershed science, and I'm also certified in MPCA's Smart Salt Training Program. Today I'm speaking in support of House File 3577 on behalf of Stop Oversalting. We appreciate the opportunity to share with you why we believe this legislation is so important. Over the last few years, we've engaged over 250 businesses in our communities in an effort to reduce overuse of de-icers. It's through education that we work. The conclusion from our work is clear. The fear of slip and fall lawsuits is the primary, by far, determinant of how much de-icer is applied. The opportunity to use best practice, to save resources and money, to protect structures, landscape, water, they're all concerns that people consider, but take a backseat to liability fears. So we are looking forward in a big way to the changes this legislation will bring. We're convinced that minus the fear factor, the message of best practice and reduction can be heard by the commercial applicators and the businesses who hire them. As a group committed to educating for clean water, we're looking forward to resuming our education efforts with our local business communities, knowing our work will be much more effective once this legislation is passed. In your packets, we've left you a teaspoon monogrammed with the initial SOS for Stop Oversalting. This little spoon holds enough de-icer to permanently pollute 5 gallons of water. We've used it a lot in our education because it helps people understand the scope of the problem, the reason to apply confidently only the amounts of de-icer needed for public safety. Thank you. We appreciate your time today. Please support House File 3577.
Thank you. Mr. Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Steve Woods. I'm the Executive Director of the Freshwater Society. My testimony is brief. We've got over 3 decades of data now collected showing a steady rise in the amount of chlorides in our lakes. It's primarily an urban problem because of the density that's been mentioned earlier. But the concern with this is that it affects eventually messes up the fishery. I like to fish. And this is something that the salt in the water is permanent. This is, as the other testifier said, an instance where we've seen the public sector achieve a lot of reduction in their use from 30% to 50% once they've gone through training. We know this works. The cities have the data how that has worked. We know that a lot of the private applicators know how to do this, but feel these other barriers to further adoption. It's very real for them. So this is an instance where the public sector is actually in front of the private sector on this. And we think this bill will help get to the point where both sectors are able to achieve those 30 to 50% reductions. So we support the bill.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Ms. Nissen and Mr. Woods. We wouldn't be here without your efforts. I had a chance to meet with some folks from Stop Oversalting in fall and had also an opportunity to talk to others among the people I represent. And this is something that's on people's minds, Mr. Chair. And the fact that we have a citizens group that's pushed us to do this is really laudable. Given the gravity of this issue, and it is immediate and it's very serious, and I think it's fine to start with a voluntary effort, but I don't see why we couldn't require this of some of these private sector partners. And I'm wondering, Representative Anselmo, do you see us heading in that direction of making this a requirement rather than a voluntary program? I support the bill, and I'm very appreciative of it, but I think the real reductions are going to happen, if we require this.
Representative Anselmo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I think our point of this bill was to try to get as much voluntary uptake on that, and that was sort of hence the way to find a way to make it easy for people to do that. That's usually the problem when you put lots of fees and costs and difficulties. You get less people to do it, and I think we'll see the results, and we don't have to do a mandate. But that just might be the small business guy in me talking.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, and I'm interested to get some data. You know, once we pass this, and I hope we pass this session, and really evaluate that, because you know, in the past we've had some voluntary programs, some have worked and some haven't, quite frankly. And I think the success we've had in cleaning up water has come from requiring certain things. So that's why we have the Clean Water Act, for example. So I'm interested. I'm supportive. But I think down the road, I want some measurable results here and an opportunity to maybe revisit this in a few years.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on Representative Hornstein's question, if the public entities are already doing it, or most of them are, is there a way, should we look at just requiring it now for all public entities if it's already there? If the threat is so real, you know, voluntary best management practices, we have lots of experience where they don't move the needle. But if it is moving the needle on the public sector, and there's maybe a few public sector ones that are not doing it, perhaps we should start with mandating that by 2019 and then provide the private sector coming in by 2022 or something like that. Do the advocates support moving towards a mandatory effort?
Mr. Woods.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, at this point, we're eager to see what a voluntary program can do. A number of other certification programs have been mentioned throughout the testimony today that exist, and they are a mix of mandatory or voluntary. I have some experience in the past with the voluntary wetland delineator certification program. In that instance, it is not a requirement, but it does provide a competitive advantage for those firms who invest in the extra training and certification, and they're able to provide that to their clients. And I'd like to see how much that can penetrate before we go in with the heavier hand of putting it system-wide.
Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Woods, that's almost a professional type of training in terms of delineating the wetland versus protecting the water. So there's it's a different competency type of measurement. I think we have a great deal of data about voluntary best management practices with other water quality issues that has not moved the needle, and we've spent huge amounts of money on. So I think that if we're saying that the public sector has been doing this, and I'm fully aware of unfunded mandates, but if we can achieve reductions by having the training now, these are some of the things we could have discussed before doing it here in open meeting. But I think there's a lot of work that could be done on this. I think it's a timid first step, but it, ultimately, we'll be back here in 2 or 3 or 5 years, and we'll need to do this as a requirement if it can show the demonstration of need.
I think I'll be back here sooner than that because we've got fiscal note. But, okay, so next, I would like to have Joel Carlson come down, please. Mr. Carlson, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And I want you to know at the onset that the association certainly supports smart salting policies. I was going to say they were laudable, but President Hornstein stole my term. This is a commendable effort, but you need to know there are some problematic provisions in the bill, and I want to just briefly point those out for you, Mr. Chairman and members. I welcome everyone to read Ms. Horton's salting manual. It's actually quite helpful. I've read it. It's not recommended bedtime reading, but it's actually quite helpful. And what we learned from this manual that they put together is that we use on some years upwards of 800,000 tons of salt per year. And one of the problems that I think we have with this legislation, if you look at lines 1.9 through 1.11, is that much of the salt that's being applied is completely exempt from the provisions of this bill. It does not apply to municipal operations, state, other governmental entities or employees, and much of the salt that is used today goes on our roads. So the commercial application is a very small percentage, not that it shouldn't be addressed, but we're really ignoring the large amount of salt application that is getting into our waterways. So we're addressing a small little problem with this bill, and we're exempting large portions of the salt applicators by the language. The second thing that I just would like you to know, and I won't turn the committee into the Civil Law Committee,
thank you,
Chairman, but to use this as a liability protection is, I think, a little bit misplaced. And the reason I say that is you need to understand that the current law in Minnesota, which we have adopted through court doctrine decades ago, is that you really don't have a premise liability claim for injuries that result from open and obvious dangers. And the courts have long held that snow and ice in Minnesota are open and obvious. So you have to have a very egregious situation before someone has a premise liability case based on snow and ice accumulation. So as a liability protection, I think that this is a little bit misplaced. As to the bill itself, Mr. Chairman and members, we do have questions about who it applies to. It applies to a commercial applicator, but that means anyone who applies it or supervises it. So are we actually requiring training of the people that are actually doing the work, or can the supervisor just go in and get the training, and we have no connection between whether or not they're training their employees on how to appropriately use it? Now, that's important because you're picking up an immunity protection, and so we really need to know who this is applying to. The second question that we have, which has been pointed out, is I don't know on lines 1.15 what it means that when the Pollution Control Agency must support a training program. Do they need to develop the training program? Do they need to adopt rules for it? What is the bright line that applicators know they need to follow in order for this bill to operate? Additionally, on the bottom of that page, it talks about additional training and recertification. What is the frequency? How often do they need to do it? These are just kind of unanswered, and without having direct rulemaking authority or directing the MPCA to develop a program until this bill becomes effective, we really don't know what it is we're asking these salt applicators to do. Mr. Chairman, I won't go deeply into the liability section on Subdivision 3 starting on 2.15, but you need to know that this is the most expansive liability protection that I've ever read in almost 25 years of representing the Association for Justice, and I'll tell you why. If you look at lines 2.19, this protection, no liability, applies to a premise owner even when they have actual notice of a dangerous condition, even when they have notice. And it doesn't apply if they fail to take any action to delete the dangerous condition when they know someone has fallen on their property. As long as I have my salt applied by a commercial applicator, I have no obligation to even go and put up a tent and one of those hazard tents that we see around the building frequently. I have no obligation to even do that. That is unique in any area of law that I'm aware of, and I really think, and I've shared this with the author as well, really needs to be addressed. Because if you don't have standards, you don't know who it applies to, and you have a complete immunity, we really have a potential for a problem here. The second thing that on the liability section, and I think you need to know about, is that this creates a presumption on behalf of the property owner that they're doing it in the right way. It's not simply an affirmative defense that I followed best management practices. It is a rebuttable presumption that's being created here, which really shifts the burden onto the injured person in a way that we really don't generally do in the civil law area. And that's important because if you look at item B, when you get to the section of how they receive the protection on 2.17, you'll notice that they have to keep a record. They have to talk about the type and rate of application that they've used for the de-icing material. But that section doesn't require them to follow best management practices. All they have to do is have been certified and take a record of what they've done, but it doesn't require them to apply best management practices to receive the liability protection. So, Mr. Chairman, those are our questions. I know we can address many of these in civil law, and we are more than willing to continue to work on this. But as written, I think there are some real problematic areas that would have unintended consequences that that would maybe defeat the well-intended purposes that you're trying to get at. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Okay. With that, Representative Anselmo, closing comments on your bill, and we're going to move on.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, and thank you for letting me spend my morning here with you and all the wonderful detailed questions. We'll look to follow up in the future committee with some of these items. And so I would invite other people to join on as co-authors. We moved this bill quickly around the floor as we were working to get it right and make some changes. And if you could take an allegorical trip down the Minnehaha, up the Minnesota River, or any lakes or river that you like that you want to make better and help save them, I'd encourage you to join. And with that, we'll close and like to have this move forward next meeting.
Thank you. With that, I would renew my motion to refer House File 3577 to civil law as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The bill is passed to civil law. Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Heintzman, House File 3556. Mr. Larson, come down, please.
Mr. Chair, we killed the bill yet this year.
This is a good one.
I don't know.
It is a good one. That's right.
We would have killed the last one, but he brought donuts.
Yeah. Good deal. Good deal.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Heintzman, I'll move House File 3556 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and please tell me you're not going to be putting salt in the back of those trucks.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right, thank you. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for allowing me the opportunity to talk about this particular bill. It's a little more lighthearted than the last one. Some of you have heard me mention in the past that I believe my district, the Lakes area, the Brainerd Lakes area, is the most recreationally diverse district in the entire state. There's lots of folks that might argue, I suppose. We all love our districts. But this particular bill is working on an issue that is fun. It's near and dear to many folks' hearts. And some people might know of the jeepers that are out there that go out on a weekend basis and travel across the state and look for opportunities to operate their vehicles off pavement. And the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association, I think, has a sensible plan for growth. I think this bill will provide the initial key elements to help build a foundation for future growth. I have with me today Dan Larson from the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association, Tony Kiefer from the Minnesota Land Rovers and Minnesota Overlanders and Four-Wheel Drive Association. So I will turn over testimony and discussion to them at this time.
Mr. Larson, welcome. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members, Dan Larson representing Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association to here speaking to you today in support of House File 3556. a bill to enhance off-road vehicle planning and development. We appreciate Representative Heitzman's leadership on this issue and the indulgence of the committee to talk to you about this exciting new riding opportunity for the state and for recreationalists. The bill before you represents the first real step in unlocking the potential in a recreational activity we believe will provide vast new opportunities to bring new socially conscious and environmentally sustainable interests, energies, and economic developments to deep rural areas of the state where it's needed most. This is an appropriations bill authorizing $600,000 from the off-road vehicle account in three equal portions for the following purposes. The first is a new contract for the administrator of the organization's top priority, and that is the nation's first ever border-to-border touring route that is projected to start on the north shore of Lake Superior, travel all the way across the northern third of the state, and end up at the North Dakota border in Pembina. When North Dakota heard about this project, they got so excited they said, bring it to Pembina, and we'll connect it, and we'll go across our state. This is an exciting new project, and it's one of 18 that we have in the queue in an effort to build a state-of-the-art regional and statewide off-road touring system in the state. So, again, $600,000 from the off-road account. The first is for a new contract for the administrator of the B2B. I just described where it'll go. And that contract runs out in June, and we want to avoid any delays or hiccups in terms of the continuity. We also have in attendance today the administrator of the B2B route. It's Ron Potter, and many of you know him. He's the person that we wanted for this. He's a Hall of Fame off-road vehicle designer, and he's on a conference call right now, but he should be available for questions if you want.
Thank you.
The second section of the bill, or section two of the bill, authorizes an appropriation to local road authorities to assist in addressing additional needs on low-volume roads attributable to the B2B volumes. And this is in response to concerns we began hearing in the first round of listening sessions, where local road authorities said, what are you going to do about the additional volumes on these low-volume roads that we don't put any money into? And so in an attempt to work with local governments and be good neighbors and good partners, this is an appropriation of $200,000. We don't know if it's enough. We don't know if it's too much, but it addresses that concern, at least initially. The third and final component of the bill is an appropriation for a comprehensive statewide master plan for off-road vehicles. With 18 projects currently in the queue, we feel we're on the threshold again of something special, and we want to do it right. We're going to be knocking on the doors of a lot of local governments with these 18 projects, and we want to come in letting them know we did our homework and that we want to build this system in the right way. So the overarching strategy going forward, building the system, is to build strong local partnerships in areas we propose to recreate and to work with them over time to invest in the community and address concerns that develop going forward. The two models for these plans that we can point to for now are parks that operate in Gilbert and in Appleton. And we've got a decade's worth of relationships, very positive in those areas, and you would be hard-pressed to find a civic, business, or law enforcement official in either of those areas that wouldn't have good things to say about the relationships that we've built over time. So I talked about the master plan and that's the bill, Mr. Chair, members. I have Tony Kiefer here, and Tony's a member of the organization and a couple of clubs. So we wanted to give a flavor of what the clubs feel and and the potential growth and benefits that this new system can provide.
Thank you. Mr. Kiefer, proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Tony Kiefer. I'm a member of the Minnesota Land Rovers, Minnesota Overland, and Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association. Just want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives, for allowing me to testify to the committee this morning. Simply speak to you as an enthusiast of trail touring, also known as overlanding. And if you're not familiar with overlanding or trail touring, really simply just getting in your vehicle with your family, friends, heading out for a few days at a time, being reliant on what you bring with you, and getting to those back roads. Visiting the historic sites, little back lakes that few, maybe many, are not willing to go the extra step to get a little further away from the hustle and bustle of what we have here in town. But overlanding trail touring, it's a rapidly growing recreational pursuit across not just North America but around the world. You just have to look at a number of different vehicle manufacturers are literally rolling out new vehicles catering specifically to this type of vehicle recreation. Many aftermarket product supports in the millions and millions of dollars. And right now, there's tremendous opportunity here in Minnesota. Northern Minnesota provides numerous resources, but at this point, really, we don't have the ability to access them in the way that we like to. Every single year, myself, members of our group, we travel outstate, Colorado, South Dakota, North Dakota, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, simply across the border to Ontario, the Thunder Bay area, where there's a better access of routes and trails to use. But in northern Minnesota, with the border-to-border opportunity, we have a tremendous chance to change that, to really build a true first-class trail network, unlike any that I'm aware of across the country. This will bring in people from out of the area across the country. I've been in touch with people from as far away as Ohio, eastern states, that are interested in this project specifically, wondering when it's going to roll out and how they can access it. A member of an organization here in Minnesota with over 380 active individuals who are ready and willing to support this trail network. Yeah, there's it's the ability to get together with whether it's younger generation, older generation, many of our different outings. We have people who are in their 20s or in their 70s. But they're all out there for that common purpose, common interest of getting out a little further and recreating and just getting away to a little peace and quiet. And what we're proposing here is really an opportunity to do that. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Larson, looking at the bill, oftentimes in a bill like this, when you're planning or looking at the preparing a route or something like that, you have a boilerplate language of complying with all federal, state, and local laws or ordinances, so that when to make sure, so we don't have a situation after the fact if somebody says, oh, that went through a wetland that wasn't supposed to go through, or, I mean, sometimes there's a just boilerplate protection to make sure that folks are looking at all the, whether it's a historic site or something, to have that included in there. Have you considered anything like that? I think that would improve the bill, just to have some reference of making sure that the planners are talking to whether it's a county or city or state or federal to make sure that they're engaged.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, that's the first time this came up. This is not the last iteration of the bill. Laura Bruce and I have been in contact. I think the department has expressed some recent issues with some of the language in the bill. We are going to be amending the bill, and we'll take that into effect. There's no reason. It's our intent and the organization's intent to operate at the highest level, to meet the highest standards of economic and cultural and environmental needs that we can.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's, I believe you, and I think that would be good language just to prevent an oops after the fact of report gets prepared and then somebody didn't think about that, and that should also make sure you're consulting with tribal governments and folks so that we're not running into problems there. And Mr. Chair, the other question I have is on line 2.28 and 2.29 at the end of the bill. And this is maybe a broader discussion. I'm comfortable with transparency of putting expenses or putting claims up online. I'm less comfortable with reviewing claims with an entity. I think as a state we're moving so much into stakeholder process and stakeholder authority, and this has nothing to do with the merits of that stakeholder, but writing into law that the state agency should review claims for reimbursement with an association, I don't know if I've seen that before, and it troubles me. I'm comfortable with having postings and transparency, then the whole public can look at it, but going with that extra step and requiring review with an association seems to me uncharted territory, and I'm not sure we want to set that precedent, because if it's one association you set the precedent with, maybe other associations and other entities, once you break that seal, you know, it could be used by other groups on other things in the future.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we'll file this under you can't blame us for trying. So I believe this is one of the things that you'll see amended in our discussions with the DNR. And so that came up in our conversation.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to have Laura Proust come down, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Laura Price. I'm the Statewide Programs and Planning Manager with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. And I would like to say that the DNR supports the appropriations in this bill. We believe that this is an important opportunity, that the planning contracts will allow a chance for a thoughtful approach to planning for these types of activities into the future, as well as we believe that the maintenance fund will be an important aspect of the success of the border-to-border route. So we've been working with MN Four-Wheel Drive and others on these touring routes. We believe that they're a good opportunity for Minnesota, and we look forward to that work. As Mr. Larson mentioned, we identified a couple of details related to the maintenance fund, concerns with just some of the specific details of the language. We want to make sure that we have a really effective and efficient process and understand the criteria associated with how we would implement that maintenance fund. So, again, we'd like to work in partnership with the authors in MN Four-Wheel Drive to iron out a couple of those details.
Okay. Members, questions? I want to address the 2.28 and 2.29. I do think that it's important to have some sort of, the groups that are paying the fees and so forth. I think it's important for them to have some oversight. I'm not sure exactly how we get there, but I think that's good. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Larson, your group recently held a series of listening meetings across the state on this issue.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, that's affirmative. This is the second round of listening sessions. The first was a broader session designed to organically have engage a broad area of local governments and tribes in terms of where this proposed route ought to be. The second a session of listening sessions is about to conclude this week, and that is in the counties where the proposed alignment is to be aligned.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Larson. So some of the questions asked already, what was the feedback from our local units of government, whether county, city, SWCDs, or anything like that as far as this plan?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, I'll give a general answer to that. We do have the trail administrator, the project administrator, if you want more details. But generally, the feedback has been positive. We have heard, I think, at every stop that local governments have been concerned about the additional volume on the local low-volume roads. We've addressed that in the bill. And one county, Clearwater County, went on record as opposing.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions on the bill? Okay. Then with that, I will renew my motion to have House file. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. So with that, Ms. Preuss, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Larson.
Thank you.
Representative Heintzman, any final comments on the bill?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for holding it over.
Thank you. House file 3556 is laid over. Okay, next up we have Representative Lewick, 2847. All right, Representative Lewick, I think Representative Hoppy, no, wait, I'm kidding. All right, so what we have here is House File 2847. I will move House File 2847 to be referred to GovOps Committee. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, committee members. This is a straightforward update bill. We have a group called the Cuyuna Country State Rec Area Advisory Committee made up of citizens from the community. It was formed in the mid-1990s when we created the state Cuyuna Country State Rec Area. Over time, a number of the organizations that provided members for that advisory group have either modified or went out of business. And so what this does is the Cuyuna Range Mineland Recreational Area Joint Powers Board no longer exists. The closest thing to that is the Cuyuna Range Economic Development Corporation, which is local community economic development agency. You look, Cuyuna Range Mineland Reclamation Committee, we needed somebody that had actively worked in the mines as part of that committee. What the committee doesn't exist, and my dad is one of the youngest members that worked in at the very end of the active mining on the Cuyuna, and he's 91 going on 92, so we're rapidly running short of young miners. The Croft Mine Historical Park Joint Powers Board no longer exists. That was dissolved over the years. The DNR actually owns the property that the old Croft Mine property. So what this does is just simply brings us up to date with the community members that are still active. This is a very important group. We meet four times a year and are very work well with the DNR, making sure that we really move this whole state rec area forward. It's a critical part of our economic development in our area. So with that, I have no testifiers. We're just trying to match what we're doing today and fix this statute, bring it up to date.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we just hear from DNR on their...
Mr. Meyer, sorry to catch you by surprise there. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, DNR, and we're working with the Cuyuna Country Board on this. It's just more of a technical correction, if anything, bringing the membership up to date. It's great to go back to your previous response about having the user groups participate. These guys are all in. They want, I mean, this, if you haven't been up there lately, go check it out. This is a state-of-the-art facility, and it's going to get a lot better. So
We support the language.
Representative Hanson. Any other questions, members? Okay, with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer to Gavox, House File 2847. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Next, House File 3421. Mr. Meyer is there.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Do you want to go through the bill? You want me to walk through it?
You can. I need to move the bill to the general or to the general register first. So I'll move House File 3421 to the general register.
Mr. Chairman, yep. Members, again, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you is part of our policy technical bill dealing with the game and fish sections, which is pretty slim. The first section allows us, as you can see, it's striking language on lines 1.9 that says we have to furnish one copy for each person obtaining a hunting, fishing, or trapping license of our regulations. And now with the internet and phones and everything, we're trying to reduce that. We want to reduce that, save a little money. Currently, we publish 1 million fishing regulations books, 700,000 hunting regulation books, and 350,000 of the waterfall synopsises. What we're proposing to do if this language would pass would be reduce that initially by 5%, so 950,000 fishing books, 665,000 hunting regulations, and then go down to 100,000 of the waterfall brochures and then see where that goes. We're in the process of looking at how is our licensing system and all of our hunting and fishing regulations going to be dealt with into the future. This is the first step in trying to get our arms around some of that reduction in costs.
Sure. And to that, I would also say I know that there's a lot of these books that are left over at the end of the year in our local hardware stores and so forth. I'm curious. You said you do 350 of the waterfowl. How many actual waterfowl stamps and licenses do you sell in Minnesota? And I know that's a surprise question, but.
Mr. Chairman, my phone a friend is saying
70,000?
70,000 waterfowl stamps.
And we do 350 books?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I know Representative Eklund's probably going to have a little discomfort with this because there's going to be fewer trees are cut down in this district. But Representative Eklund, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was just wondering, asked the Assistant Commissioner if this was a way to alleviate part of the new forest cut that came out last week, if that's going to be part of the problem or part of the solution.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eklund. No, but believe me, we've been going through our share of paper as we've been publishing EISs and EAWs lately, so there's a lot of paper there. Mr. Chairman, if there's no other questions, I'll move on to the next section of the bill.
Representative Sundin has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stein, there's one problem when we fix some of these remote lakes up north. You know, states have the laws in front of you. Cell phones don't come in up there. Totally eliminate any of these printed materials would be foolish. I think it could be available for it in text form for anybody finalizing at any point. The electronic notifications just simply don't work.
Representative Sundin, the bill is just allowing some flexibility in how many books they actually print. They're not eliminating the books, but. Mr. Meyer, Commissioner Meyer, excuse
me. Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a great point. We want to make sure people are successful and have these laws and the rules in their hands. So trying to find the sweet spot here is where we want to go. Having language that's kind of antiquated, in our opinion, that says we have to print one for every person who buys a license, we just feel it is limiting for us right now.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just know that I have paper coming by district.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hanson.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just looking. This bill is going to the general register. Is that?
Yes.
So it looks like it pertains to elk, and elk are cervidae, right? Elk are cervidae, and there's cervidae farms. So this is on the general register then, right?
And I don't believe there's any reference to ag statutes in the bill.
But there is to elk, right?
There are. In Kitson County and Marshall County and Beltrami County.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Meyer, you want to continue with the bill?
Mr. Chairman, members, as Representative Hansen was stating, the next two sections do pertain to elk and actually specifically language that's in 97A443. What we're trying to do here in Section 2 is to allow the landowner who gets this landowner permit, there's only several of them issued right now. We'll be looking at what the hunting levels will be here shortly as we're dealing with those herd numbers that are there and things. So there'll be more permits available this year, I'm assuming. But what we're allowing for in this language, we allow that landowner the ability to sell that license to someone at no more than the original cost of the license, thereby creating a little bit of value, we hope, within the residents of the area with the elk herd. There's concerns that we're trying to work through the damage to crop farm fields and fences and hay and things like that. So we're trying to allow these landowners the ability to sell a license to someone who would then be able to come up and hunt on their property possibly or somewhere else. So that's all we're asking for. And, again, the main thing is that it's no more than the original cost of the license. So that's the premise under Section 2. Section 3 deals with the lottery right now. The way our moose lottery used to work, and hopefully will work again at some point in time, where that if you there's a successful drawing, there's a drawing for 20% of the licenses after you've applied for at least 10 times and never received a license. So we want that person to, they want that person to go into that lottery. Then if they're not successful, they go back into the other pool as well. So this is identical to the way that we used to operate the moose license. We will need to make sure, hopefully, Mr. Chairman, at some point in time, when we do go back to the wolf hunting season, that we have this same language in the wolf lottery section. It's only fair if a person applies 10 times that they maybe get two bites at the apple, possibly. It has to be 10 consecutive times, right? So I can stand for any questions. Actually, it doesn't say, it just says at least 10 times. The moose used to be 10 consecutive times, so I apologize.
Yeah, and to the points on both Section 2 and 3, I know that the landowners in eastern Kitson County, I met with some of them last week, and this is an issue that's very near and dear to them. They have a couple of licenses available that they could actually transfer to somebody else or sell, and they understand how that system could work, and it's met with a very favorable review from the people that I've talked to. And in terms of the other Section 3, for those of us that have applied 10 times and not consecutively, though, it's a good provision.
Mr. Chairman, that's the bill before us.
Questions, members? Okay. With that, I will renew my motion to move House File 3421 to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Aye. Okay. Next, members, will just be tomorrow. We will be doing a tourism update. The Representative Swadzinski will be chairing that part of it. We have NEFSA's House File 3089 and also Smith's 3095. That's about it. Okay. Anything else for the benefit of the group? Thank you. Have a great day, everyone.